So I've been assigned by the organizers to talk not just about CMB, but to give a rather broader overview of what we know and what we don't know and what we maybe should know about stuff related to first order perturbation theory. And I've also been assigned to try to provoke you as much as possible early in the morning here to think about various things. So what I'm going to talk about is work done in collaboration with this cast of characters. My students Xiaoming Wang and Yong Zhengzhu are over there, and Matthias Aldiraga and Andrew Hamilton and the Sloan team are not, except for a lot of members. And the red font here symbolizes postdocs who will be applying for jobs during this fall. So there's Yong Shu. And as a special reward for those of you who managed to endure this 40-minute talk and stay awake until the end, I've been given special permission by the spokesperson of the Sloan Project to show you some preliminary Sloan power spectrum results, okay? So if you sleep through the first half hour, make sure you wake up before the end. So the reason we're all here in Santa Barbara today is because there's been this dramatic progress on the experimental side, of course, in a range of areas. It's given us all this gorgeous data. And that, in turn, has enabled fantastic theoretical progress. And we've now managed to nail down a whole list of cosmological parameters to varying degrees of accuracy here. And I remember last time I gave a talk here at the ITP, we were all so excited about measuring these cosmological parameters. And now, it's kind of been there, done that. And I don't know, who here feels that there's nothing whatsoever boring about measuring cosmological parameters? Raise your hand. who feels that they're beginning to get a little bit bored by cosmological parameters?
Next talk.
Okay. Yet, one thing that's for certain is that the experimentalists are showing no sign whatsoever of slowing down, right? So data just keeps pouring in. So what are we going to do then if it's so boring? One option is switching to biophysics, which is clearly a booming field. What I want to do during the rest of this talk is give you my own rather personal vision of what I think is an exciting area to funnel all this extra statistical power. I think there's a fork in the road here, basically. We can either keep doing exactly what we've been doing with better and better data, and so measure these parameters to yet another decimal place, which is a worthwhile thing to do, and it will be done, I'm sure. Or we can use this new data to try to raise the ambition level and do something different. And what excites me the most is testing rather than assuming all this underlying physics. Because there's a ton of assumptions that go into all this, of course.
But we've only got one decimal point.
That's your fault. So, to give you the basic conclusions first, I think cosmological parameters are gradually going to become out, and instead cosmological functions are going to be in. Because although there's a bewildering number of cosmological parameters, like 12 or so we keep talking about, really, as I hope to convince you, there's only about two or three functions. And you can measure them rather than parameterizing them with a bunch of not necessarily correct set of parameters, with much fewer assumptions. And many of the parameters are just parameterizations of these functions. And I think also these free functions form a kind of natural data compression, a natural battleground where theorists can slug it out with experimentalists. Because if you measure the same cosmological function from two different physical approaches, from CMB and from Lyman Alpha Forest, and they disagree, so you know you can blame the observers. Whereas if the functions are measured to be the same from lots of different kinds of data, and then disagree with theorists, then it's our fault. Not your fault. Okay, so this is where we're heading. Now, I think a large fraction of all the questions we're going to be discussing here this week are really questions about the metric of space-time. On the larger scale, we're asking what's the topology of space-time, what's its curvature. On slightly smaller scales, we're asking what's the expansion history of space. That tells us about dark energy, right? A of t. And we're asking about questions about the fluctuations in space-time, because that tells us about dark matter. and they grow. And a large fraction of all the observations are also really direct measurements of space-time, which don't really assume a whole lot about theory of gravity or and some such. For instance, we make measurements of we study null geodesics. And when we do gravitational lensing, when we look at the microwave background, angular diameter distance kind of stuff, when we do luminosity distance kind of stuff with supernovae, we measure non-null geodesics when we look at the orbits of stars or galaxies, when we look at the motions of galaxies or dark matter particles. So we're getting direct probes of the metric. So what is the metric of our universe? Well, if we assume the cosmological principle, that is, that there's nothing really special about our location, right, then the observed near isotropy of the CMB tells us that the zeroth order, it's just the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric with tiny fluctuations around it. So the zeroth order, this is the metric, and we're going to try to count our parameters and functions here. There's only one parameter here, the curvature, and then there's a free function, A of t. And if the field equations of general relativity are correct, right, then you get a prediction for what A of t should be. It's the Friedman equation. But I say, hey, let's measure this function, and then we can test that prediction. The first order, since we Fourier transform everything in sight and linearize, and we know that the fluctuations of different wave numbers decouple, so the fluctuations of the function of redshift and k can be factored as some initial fluctuations, which tell us about the early universe, times transfer functions, which tell us how these guys grow. So at the first order, this is all we need to measure and talk about. And then it gets harder, of course, when you go to high order. So we're going to limit ourselves to zeroth and first order for the next half hour here. So let's talk about the zeroth order function, A of t. How does the universe expand over time? To make connections with observation, it's more convenient to take the logarithm of this and then to take the time derivative. That gives us h of z, the Hubble parameter. Right? And if the Friedman equation is correct, squaring h just gives you the density. So it's convenient to plot h squared as a function of redshift. And I think that's going to be a real fun function to measure over the next few years because, as this indicates, there are a lot of different kinds of observations over many different redshifts that are sensitive to this. And we should be able to measure this fairly non-parametrically. To connect with cosmological parameters, usually we make the assumption that this is a quartic polynomial. We say there is a cubic term of slope 3, which is a density contribution from ordinary and dark matter, right? And then we say there is a constant term due to lambda. And then curvature gives a thing of slope 2. And photons would give something of slope 4. And it's very fashionable to talk about double constant W. Well, W, when you hear W, I want you to just think power law, because that's all it is. If you assume a constant W, it just assumes that there's another contribution here, which is a straight line in this plane. And W determines what slope it has. But we can measure this function without even introducing all these parameters, right? And I think that'll be a nice thing to do. And then people can fit their favorite dark energy models to it. This is something which Yun Wang and Peter Gardnerich also did nice work on. So let's look at what the data says so far. The best measurements we have of this is so far from supernovae. You take the 92 supernovae 1A that we have, public, and from the two teams, and just plot the luminosity distance dimensionless here against redshift. And the thing we're after, the density as a function of redshift, is basically just this, the derivative of this to the power minus 2. So the reason that the derivative is getting shallower here is clearly because the density is higher at high redshift, right? And when you work through the math and say, well, what is this density as a function of redshift? These are the current constraints. And the SNAP, of course, is going to do way, way better and also allow nice, fairly non-parametric reconstructions of this. Many of you have written papers on how well you can determine these things. What you should take away from this is just that it's very blatantly obvious that the slope of this curve at low redshift is not 3, which is what it would be if there were no dark energy. So, and that you can currently get a fine fit by just adding in a little lambda component like that. Let's move on now to from zeroth order to first order. So here, basically, the key of the observable is the power spectrum, as a function of both scale and also redshift. That's a really fun development, I think, in recent years, and ongoing, that we're able to measure PFK not just at very high redshift and today, like with Sloan or 2DF, but also in all sorts of ways in between here. And I think it's very encouraging that we'll be able to cross-check different observations against each other without even involving theory here very much. And thanks to the success of a HALO model, we may even be able to make some sense of what we see here in the evil nonlinear regime, shown in red. So what do we know about this so far? Well, at redshift zero, what I'm going to try to convince you of most of the remainder of this talk is that we can plot in this plot not only measurements of P of K from galaxy redshift surveys, but also clusters, and indeed microwave background measurements. First time I saw CMB points plotted in K-space like this, it was in a paper by Martin White and Douglas Scott and Joe Silk almost 10 years ago, when you only really had measurements over here. What's really nice that's happened since is that the angular resolution has improved in the CMBs. The CMB has forged to the east, and at the same time, galaxy surveys have gotten deeper and forged to the west. And you can see there's now overlap by more than a factor of 10 in scale, which allows also the cool cross-checks and testing assumptions, as I'll get to. I'm going to try to convince you that you can also put Lyman alpha forest points on the same curve, and even lensing points. So I think this curve will be a fruitful battleground where we can basically put everything and try to distinguish problems with theory from problems with observation, and so on. So unification is sort of a common theme I want to stress here, that there aren't really a gazillion separately important cosmological parameters. There's a very small number of functions, really, that everything is probing. Likewise, there aren't really a gazillion completely independent observations, because most of them can be interpreted in terms of measuring this curve or the other curve.
Are all these absolutely
normalized? So there's a very crucial assumption that goes into putting some things on here, which is that you know the transfer functions, which depend on the matter budget and on the reionization optical depth. Now, I'll get back to that very crucial point at the end. But just bear that caveat in mind. If you're really brave, like Chris Koshanek and Neil Dalal are, then you can even extend this axis by another bunch of magnitudes and put in points from lensing substructure here. So let's walk through one of these at a time. Now, C sub L's, first of all, it's been another bumper year, of course, for the micro background, with awesome new measurements from CBI, giving unprecedented angular resolution, and I'll hear a lot more this afternoon from VSA also in May this year. And of course, last year we had another great year with cool stuff from Maxima and from DAISY. Unfortunately, the DAISY team couldn't come out here, but we'll hear, I think, from most of the other groups this afternoon, and from Boomerang, and from various other competing efforts. And actually, I think it's interesting not only that some of the competing efforts have exactly the same color scheme, but I think what this researcher was trying to get across is that non-Gaussianity is another very interesting thing one can study with high precision data. And of course, January 2, 2003, you can download these maps from the map team, because that's when they're supposed to go public. So if any of the experimental teams are planning on making their maps public, like Maxima or Boomerang or DAISY, try to do it before January 2, okay? The power spectrum is lots of fun to look at these days, of course. The new things this year are the VSA points in purple here, and the CBI points shown here in green. And if we have this meeting next summer, of course, MAP will have really cleaned everything up here, but these will still stand. These will not get eclipsed from MAP, which only has angular resolution out to about here. And we'll hear also, hoping from Bill Holtzapfel, about cool Akbar results, which probably the same scales. This is sort of a bewildering plot. So here you see the same data again, just basically averaged together in bands, including the complicated effects of window functions and calibration errors and beam errors. And so this is what you see. Now, when you see this, it's easy to get a little bit too carried away, I think, and say that, hey, you know, if, now that we have this data with all these cool peaks, there's no way this could possibly be anything other than the Sachs-Wolfe plateau and the first acoustic oscillation from redshift of 1,000 and the second peak in it, and so on. We just have to be correct. There's no need for all this garbage testing assumptions that Max is talking about. And of course, the reason I'm showing you this plot is it has absolutely nothing to do with CMB. I stole it from Douglas Scott. It shows the grand unified cosmic spectrum as a function of wavelengths. Just so we should just be a little humble. Now, I promised I would map these CMB points into k-space. So how do we do that? Well, when you run CMB fast, what CMB fast is doing is it's just computing a transfer function, right? And when you compute C sub L at L of 128, for example, it computes this transfer function, and then it multiplies this by the primordial spectrum and integrates. So actually, that means instead of doing some fancy attempt at deconvolution to get PFK out of the C sub Ls, we can say, hey, we're cosmologists. We're not afraid of window functions. We work with them all the time. We're just going to interpret this as a window function. We'll normalize it to have unit area, and then we'll compute its median and its 20th and 80th percentiles, and then we'll plot for each L what k range you're probing. So you see L of 100 is probing roughly this k range here when you use unpolarized stuff. And you see what's very nice here is this is actually a pretty tight relation between L and k, especially when you go to high L. And it's also very nice and tight when you do cross-polarization and e-polarization. I'm just offset them here to avoid clutter. And that means that we can take these points and map them into case and plot them directly in k space. There's additional smearing because there are also window functions here. This band power is measuring a linear combination of a bunch of C sub Ls, but a linear combination of a linear combination is still just a linear combination, right? So we can convolve these windows with those physics windows from CMB fast and get these windows, which then tell us, you know, where what range of k-space, like the 12th band power there, was probing, and then we can put them in k-space. So we can take this plot, and we can add the CMB to it. Okay? Let me just make a few comments. The cluster point here, I plotted not at 8 megaparsec. It really is, as Martin White and Elena Pierpaoli and Douglas Scott and among others have stressed, clusters are basically sensitive to about 14 H inverse megaparsecs. And for the error bars here, I've just with Matthias Saldarriaga and I, this is all work done with Matthias, we just took the spread in the literature. But if you look at the CMB points, I think it's really nice to see that there's over an order of magnitude set of overlap now between CMB and galaxy clustering measurements. And this is, of course, just going to get better. Lyman Alpha Forest. That's another very fun area, I think, for linear perturbation theory. There was, if you take a spectrum of a distant quasar and you zoom in on it with really high resolution, you see all these wiggles, which of course are known as the Lyman Alpha Forest. And as you know, that's nothing but the signature of absorption from hydrogen, moderately nonlinear only, along the line of sight between you and the quasar. So there was a heroic effort by Rupert Croft and collaborators recently to reconstruct the power spectrum of these guys in these funny units, and a very nice reanalysis of that by Gnadin and Hamilton, running a wide grid of n-body codes, concluded that basically worked, and they made a few correct minor improvements. And this could be mapped straight into k-space also. So you can take this plot and add these guys in here, with a caveat that you've measured the power spectrum really at a redshift of 2.7 or so, so that putting them into this plot depends on your assumed value of omega and lambda and things like that, which I'll get back to. This is another area where I think you're going to see really fun development soon. There's a very nice project done within the Sloan collaboration led by Lam Hui, which is doing not 24 quasars, but thousands of quasars, not with Kairos. So you won't have able to do things down on these very small scales, but you'll be able to push to even larger scales and get still better overlap with these other experiments from Lyman Alpha Forest. And I'm very much looking forward to that. What else do we have? Well, we talked about lensing. So this is, of course, strong lensing. When you have weak lensing, all you get is the distant objects appear slightly elliptical in a correlated fashion. And it's this correlated signal that's measured. And it tells us about the clustering of the dark matter between you and the distant objects, galaxies, as it were. And this is another field which I find very exciting. It reminds me a lot of the way CMB used to be shortly after the COBE discovery, because the first detections of weak lensing were only done 2 years ago by four teams, right? So that was like the COBE of that field. And already we're getting measurements now with these really stunning, these small error bars. And the largest area covered so far is a whopping 53 square degrees by Hoekstra et al. And although there are still major issues here with systematics and so on in this game, just like there were with CMB back in those days, right? The raw precision and the statistical potential of this is, I think, stunning. Don't agonize about what aperture mass means or shear correlation function means or anything like that. All you need to remember is that what these data points we're measuring were, again, just weighted averages of the matter power spectrum. But this time it's a bit trickier. It's weighted averages of the dark matter power spectrum, of the nonlinear power spectrum. And I was showing you a plot of the linear power spectrum, right? So what Matthias Eldrag and I did was we re-expressed this as a weighted as a window function on the linear power spectrum using the Peacock and Dodds ansatz. And then you see you get window functions that are a lot narrower and also a lot more on large scales. So doing the same thing as I did for the CMB here, you can see what angle of aperture mass corresponds to what k's, and you see that really, for looking at probing the linear power spectrum, lensing probes a lot larger scales than you may intuitively think, which I think is nice, because we have so many other measurements on these large scales that we want to connect to. So we can take this plot, and we can add in the lensing points, and here they are. This linear-nonlinear mapping also explains why you don't get as big a dynamic range in K from lensing as you get it if you just look at the ratio of thetas, right? But it's fun that it's almost touching the CMB points already in terms of the K that it's covering. And there's a lot of overlap with Lyman alpha, and it's pretty close to cluster scale too. Okay. So now let's reward those of you who are still awake by showing you something you have probably not seen before, which are some very preliminary power spectrum measurements from Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Now, let me first stress that two things. This is very preliminary. You won't find an astro pH, and so all the necessary caveats apply. Second, that although it's an honor for me to be allowed to present this, this is a real team effort, of course, involving huge amounts of work by huge numbers of people. And particular thanks go to Mike Blanton, who's done an enormous amount of work here with everything from sample construction to radial selection function estimation to the variety of other nitty-gritty things here. Fiona Hoyle for lots of help with Monte Carlo simulations, and Michael Strauss, Michael Vogley, and David Weinberg for lots of useful suggestions and feedback. Also for Edith Zahavi and Adrian Pope, who have been doing a lot of cross-checks against independent analysis code, and also very much to Josh Freeman now at Soleil, who have tirelessly spearheaded and organized this effort for a very long time and kept it going. And also thanks a lot to Andrew Hamilton for letting me use a lot of code that we've worked on together before. So what data goes into this? Well, about 165,000 galaxies before cuts. And this is the area of sky that it covers. And when the Sloan survey is complete, the idea is to fill in this entire region, of course, in the northern sky like that, which is supposed to be this cone shape here, and these three outrigger stripes in the south you can see there. If you zoom in on this a bit more in detail, though, you see that since we're not done, there's a very patchy and complicated sky mask. And one of the most painful things about doing this has been that we have to model this very, very accurately, because the method I'll show involves expanding exactly this in spherical harmonics up to L of 300. So you have to spend a lot of time on that. And in the radial direction, this is the distribution in terms of co-moving distance, assuming a flat lambda 0.7 model. And I'm also going to show you some results when you break up the sample into a bunch of volume-limited subsamples with different absolute magnitudes. to get a grip on bias and such things. If you look in the slice of the equator and what the galaxies actually look like, here they are for four of those mag-limited samples. I think it's fun that even for these very luminous, distant guys, even though it's pretty sparse, you can see, still see a lot of clustering by eye. Here are the other four samples there. So what did we do? Well, many of you in this room have thought a lot about how to analyze this kind of data set before. And the analysis I'm going to show you basically takes the route of taking all the raw data and expanding it in so-called pseudo-Karhunen-Loeb eigenmodes, and then using those to measure the power spectrum and then getting parameters from there. But Josh Freeman in his talk is going to tell you about other complementary analyses that have been done within the Sloan collaboration that also go other routes, so we can cross-check and get other results. And rather than bore you with a ton of math for how these modes work and how we derive them, let me just show them to you, okay? So we have 4,000 of these functions in 3D. In terms of their angular dependence, there's one that looks like a monopole, one that looks sort of like a dipole, and then other ones that wiggle progressively more and more and more, sort of like spherical harmonics, but on the cut sky, or orthogonal. And then in terms of their radial dependence, if we look again in the slice here of the equator, there are smooth functions and then ones that wiggle more and more, again probing smaller and smaller scales. Then there are also a bunch of special modes. We use modes which are purely radial in their dependence, because they're like lightning rods for any problems related to misestimates of the selection function or evolution or things like that. And likewise, we have a bunch of modes which are purely angular, which pick up any problems we have with extinction corrections or other purely angular issues. And then all the modes are orthogonal to all the others. So if you find any problems with any of these special modes, you can just throw them away and not use them. And all the other ones are orthogonal and, in a sense, immune to such problems, which has been a very powerful test for systematic errors. So we have a density field in three dimensions. We expand this in these 4,000 different functions I showed you some pictures of. So we get 4,000 numbers, expansion coefficients, right? And here's what they look like. And now, you can just see people like Lloyd Knox going, ah, I can do this, because this is exactly isomorphic to a microwave background problem. Right? You can say, I have 4,000 pixels or whatever, and the variance in each one just depends in some linear way on some power spectrum. So we've been able to use a lot of very powerful techniques that have been developed and used by so many of you for CMB analysis to this problem too. And here's what we get. Now, this power spectrum, although it's quite well fit by just your sort of standard concordance model, is actually quite a misleading plot, because it grossly overrepresents the amount of information that's present here, which are two reasons. One is that the error bars at different k here are correlated, especially on the left side. And second, the measurement at any given k is really just the true power spectrum convolved with some window functions. Right? We compute these window functions analytically, and they're quite broad, as you can see. So you don't have a lot of independent information about what's going on out here, for instance. So what we do to get a fairer way of presenting the data is we use a so-called square of the Fisher matrix trick, and create uncorrelated measurements, has a side benefit of also getting much nicer window functions, or narrower like this. And this is what the data looks like then. So look at these blue points here. These are all points now with errors that are uncorrelated when you include both shot noise and sample variance. This is just some very preliminary stuff with a luminous red galaxy sample from Sloan, which is more biased and should ultimately be able to teach us about what's going on out here too. Comparing this with the 2DF analysis, this is the analysis that Yong Zhong and I and Andrew did with the 2DF data. You see pretty good agreement. The Sloan error bars are already slightly smaller here on a range of scales. But before one goes out and plots this as measurement of the linear power spectrum, one has to worry about bias. There's one particular effect that's very important here because this is a magnitude-limited sample. So galaxies that are far away tend to be more luminous. And that can give you an artificial tilt of your power spectrum, which we need to quantify. So we want to measure, in other words, we want to know what the dark matter clustering is like, rather than just what the galaxies are doing. So we need to know the relationship between this and this. So what we did was we took these subsamples, and we measured the power spectrum separately for each one. And we were very happy to find that nature seems to be kind here, and have been giving basically the same shape of the power spectrum for all of these different kinds. It's offset by different factors, which means you can get them to lie on top of each other like this by just shifting them vertically. You can see this more clearly if you just divide by a curve that has this common shape, but these are all consistent with being just horizontal. So you can fit for what the best fit bias is as a function of absolute magnitude of your galaxies, and then this is what you get. The triangles show an independent, totally independent analysis by Edith Sahavi et al. Using the correlation functions, and the cyan curve shows some stuff done by the 2DF team. So now that we've measured how the bias depends on the luminosity of galaxies, what we can do is we can say, okay, at each, when we measure the power at k of 0.3, for instance, we know how much information is coming from different distance scales from us. And at each distance, we also know what the distribution of galaxy luminosities is, because we know the luminosity function, right? So we can convolve those two things and say that the measurement at k of 0.3 is measuring this. It has a bias, which is a weighted average of this bias function. And we know the weight. So here is the answer. We have indeed this systematic problem where we get an artificial blue tilt, and we can measure it. We can quantify it. So this is the curve we need to correct by. It may look like a very small correction, but it's not that ridiculously small, a 10% change in bias here, because I can, we just square that to get P of K, and that can easily masquerade as, you know, n of 0.9 instead of 0.1, and it's important to correct for. So we correct for that, and here's what we get. And if you look at that, of course, there's been a lot of talk about wiggles recently from a variety of surveys, and so we couldn't resist the temptation to just fit some curves to it, and you squint a little bit, it certainly looks like you get a very good fit by this black curve there. To be a little more quantitative, though, of course, what you want to do is to cause some cosmological parameters. If you say n equals 1 as your prior, and plot constraints on omega matter versus barren fraction, this is sort of the favored region. If you put a prior on H, it tightens up a little bit. This is quite a high barren fraction. So if you put in the nucleosynthesis constraints, it pushes you down there. And this is actually perfectly consistent, though, because this is actually the 1 sigma contour right there. So everything hangs together quite nicely. And that's about all I wanted to say about that. To put this in perspective, though, just so you don't have, to make sure you haven't gotten too jaded by all sorts of recent galaxy stuff, this, look how recent this is. Michael Vogley made this nice compilation 3 years ago. But everything that was known about the galaxy power spectrum. And he didn't even bother putting error bars on it. He said, Max, I didn't put the error bars on there because I didn't believe them. And in hindsight, he's probably right, because like if you look these points, for example, they're quite far from where 2DF and Sloan have now measured the curve to be here. And we've come a long way from there to there, I think, in a quite short time, right? And so this is all CMB, cluster, lensing, and Lyman alpha 4 stuff that we talked about. And boom, there's the Sloan data. And here again, for wiggle buffs, I encourage you to look sort of in this region. OK, so let's come back to the question that Bruce Weinstein asked, because it's a very, very crucial one. There's a big assumption going into this. When you put in CMB points here, for instance, which is transfer functions, and we talked about testing assumptions. That was, in fact, the main theme of my talk, right? So if we want to measure the primordial power spectrum from this, how do we do it? The power spectrum we measure is a product of that function and some transfer functions, right? And you might a priori think that it's impossible to uniquely factorize a number into two numbers. There are infinitely many ways of doing that, right? So this is doomed to fail. But let me try to convince you that it's not doomed to fail. If you knew, first of all, what the transfer functions, they only depend on the matter budget, by which I mean, you know, the baryon density, the dark matter density, the neutrino density, and all that kind of stuff. And also on the reionization optical depth. Whereas this, of course, is usually parameterized by parameters like n sub s, a sub s, n sub t, a sub t, the inflation business. But for this talk, it's just a free function, cosmological function we want to measure. If we knew the matter budget, then what we could do is we could take this curve and we could divide it by the transfer function that comes out of CMB fast, and here's what we would get. We get a measurement directly of this cosmological function, which is the primordial power spectrum, with some window functions. So we've not assumed that it's of any form, we've just plotted measurements on it. Right? You see there's a lot of scatter here, so this shows that it's going to be really nice to get this extra oomph, you know, of precision that, for example, the complete Sloan and MAP are going to give us, because then, look at these error bars, how they're going to tighten up. We'll be able to say some really, really strong things about this. And to compare, this is n of 1.1, this is n of 0.9, right, which are sort of the current 1 sigma limits on the slope of that curve. We'll even be able to say if there are small-scale features and stuff. But that's if we knew the matter budget. We don't know the matter budget, right? So how are we going to break this degeneracy between the matter budget and this curve? Well, fortunately, these different kinds of measurements depend in very different ways on the matter budget. For instance, if I just look at CMB and galaxy clustering, if I increase the baryon fraction when I make this reconstruction, you see, it's going to affect where the CMB points land here, but it's not going to affect the galaxy points at all, of course, because they were measured in this space. So pretty soon you reach the point where you say, this is totally inconsistent with that. So this large baryon model is ruled out. And that's independent of anything, any assumptions about the initial power spectrum. Right? So what I'm trying to tell you here is, you can measure the matter budget without assuming anything about inflation, if you want. Just because there happens to be a large overlap in scale here between the CMB and large scale structure. We can see this more clearly if we look at the initial power spectrum instead. So this is running simulations assuming a standard n equals 1 thing coming out of inflation and making this plot with a ridiculously high baryon fraction. So you can still fool the CMB and by choosing to think this is okay, by picking an initial power spectrum that has this ridiculous shape with a feature like that, I'm sure one of the inflation theorists in the room can come up with a model that predicts this. And but you can't. But then you're going to be completely inconsistent with Sloan, right? So then you can say whatever inflation says, you know, this matter budget is simply ruled out. So I think when the MAP data is out, this will be a very fun kind of game to play. And you can do it also without using large-scale structure by using CMB polarization as an independent test. This is just one example of that. If you take Planck and you go ahead and say, here's a ridiculously high baryon model, so you're going to fit it by having some, you're again come up with an inflation model that predicts this initial power spectrum, it's going to predict a dip here at exactly the place where the polarized data from Planck requires you to have a huge bump in the initial power spectrum. Again, you know, model ruled out. So you can put very strong constraints on the matter budget if you have CMB polarization without assuming anything about inflation. The reason this works is just because of the convenient fact that, as you know, polarization has bumps in its power spectrum. This is a revenge for showing that cream pie thing in the beginning. Because although the computer is a Mac, software is from Microsoft. Yeah, there are only 200 few graphs left. Let's skip that polarization movie since Bill Gates didn't like it. It's my second last view graph. And just to conclude everything, the message I've been trying to tell you, give here is that really, although 11, 12 cosmological parameters that are fashionable now sounds like a very bewildering set of numbers, right? Really, it's not that complicated. But really, all the stuff that you measure to zero in the first order depend just on these functions, A of t, and then the power spectrum of k and z. Moreover, the power spectrum can be factored as a product of the primordial power spectrum and these transfer functions. And we can break the degeneracy between the two. The curvature also fits in to the zeroth order there. And there's a huge list of different kinds of observables in physics, and this complicated table is just supposed to show that basically there's an enormous number of possible cross-checks you can make where many different kinds of physics are probed by different things here. And to close, I think this is basically what we know about the universe so far at the zeroth order, and this is basically what we know first order. And since data is just going to keep pouring in, it's just fantastic, great, thanks to those of you who are not theorists in the room, I think rather than use all this spectacular data to just try to get more decimal places, I think it'll be a really fun challenge for theorists to try to use this data to raise the ambition level beyond just fitting to some cosmological parameters, which may be in the wrong class of models altogether, and rather raise the ambition level and try to measure some cosmological functions and really test rather than assume the underlying physics. Thanks. Yeah.
Are those constraints in omega baryon and omega minor parameter space, do those come from the Wiggles or just from the peak and the transfer function?
I think they come mainly actually from the suppression due to baryons from the peak rather than from the wiggliness itself.
Okay.
But the sort of tests that have been done using the Fisher matrix formalism, there was a nice paper by Goldberg and Strauss a few years ago, and I also did one where they basically show that with the full power of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, when it's complete, you really should be able to statistically see the wiggles. It's maybe 3 sigma or so. So I think that's a really nice motivation for getting all that data. Ewan. Yes, indeed. So the paper that Yun Wang wrote with David Spergel on showing how well you can measure the primordial power spectrum from combining Planck or MAP and Sloan, I think is very complementary to this, because the approach in that paper was to say, let's parameterize the initial power spectrum, not in the usual way with two parameters, an amplitude and a slope, or maybe a curvature, but as a piecewise constant function. And then they did a nice Fisher matrix analysis and stuff. Whereas what I tried to show you here was that you don't actually need to parameterize at all. You can just take your measurements directly and plot them with the appropriate window functions as measuring that thing. So that they're very complementary indeed.